Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. It's a simple subject, but what do you do if you're commuting to work and suddenly you're in a fender bender? Here's Chris.
You've just traded paint with another driver on the freeway. Your car's stopped. You're okay, but the car's damaged, but not too bad. Traffic's backing up behind you. You're starting to feel a little panic. What do you do? Trooper Kyle Yarbrough with the State Patrol says if you aren't injured, you should move your car out of the way if you're able to do so.
It's okay to clear your vehicle to the right-hand shoulder. If someone's injured or your vehicles can't move, that's understandable that you have to stay where you are and wait for emergency personnel to come there. But if both of your vehicles operate and you're comfortable, you can move it to the right-hand shoulder, and troopers can investigate that collision just as well on the right-hand shoulder or off an exit ramp, you know, down on the surface street as we can on the freeway.
Do not start discussing insurance information, arguing over fault with the other driver, or taking pictures of the damage in the middle of the freeway.
Even if you're not comfortable moving your vehicles, wait in your car. I've gone to plenty of collisions where, there's two or three cars and people are attempting to exchange information in the roadway. And that's not the place to do it.
Staying in your car until help arrives is usually also the safest place to be.
You know, there's cars going by, there's people not paying attention, there's all this stuff going on. So I definitely don't recommend conferencing with other motorists, you know, in lane 4 downtown. Talk to everyone, get up a plan, and move to the right-hand shoulder. And if you're not comfortable with that, just get back in your car, call 911, and put your seatbelt back on.
So again, bottom line, move the car out of the way. You don't need to stay there as long as you can move your car and there aren't any injuries. Now, the next topic, what's up with all the bright headlights? I probably get more emails about this topic than any other, and that includes the emails about left lane camping and tolling. Drivers are constantly asking me if the intensity of the lights on cars have changed. They complain of being blinded by the traffic behind them. I see the same thing. I've had to flip my rear view mirror more times in the last couple of years than I ever have before.
It seems like modern headlight technology is brighter. I've even caught myself like, oh, this guy's got his brights on, and then you get close and it's a newer model car, and you're just like, oh, that's LED headlight technology. It's just brighter.
Trooper Yarbrough says if you're putting in new lights yourself, say you want to upgrade to LEDs, make sure you're following the law. They can only be so bright, and some are prohibited.
Some aftermarket lights go outside of the light spectrum that is allowed on headlights in Washington. So before you purchase an aftermarket high-intensity headlight kit, you can just Google the Washington Administrative Code vehicle equipment. And there's a light spectrum that they have to fall into.
And then, of course, there are all the other requirements about where they could be on your car.
They have to be a certain height above the ground, and then they can't get too high above your ground. And that goes for your bumper. And that's just so your headlights remain effective as far as lighting up the roadway. And like you said, making sure you're not putting headlights right in everyone's rearview mirror all the time.
So to all of my drivers who are asking me and emailing me, no, you're not crazy. The lights are a lot brighter out there. And I've also noticed a lot more people who keep their brights on all the time for no good reason. I think that's one of the downsides of the technology where you can keep your lights in automatic bright mode. Yeah. So they go on and off depending on when the car wants them to. And sometimes they stay on maybe when you don't realize it or they're activated when they shouldn't be. I never use that function because I don't want to be the guy who's blinding the driver in front of me.
It's common courtesy.
But yeah.
Can troopers ticket you for that?
I think they can ticket you if you found out that they've got if they see the brights and they pull you over for something else and they go, oh, you've got an aftermarket kit on here. It's going to be hard to tell because, again, as Trooper Yarbrough said, the intensity of the lights, you know, it's just LED technology. But yeah, they are brighter.
Yeah. And since Memorial Day is coming up, we thought we'd get you ready for the weekend. Here is Tracy Taylor.
Memorial Day weekend is known to be the unofficial start to summer, which means more campers, boats, and trucks already on crowded roads. DOT has come out with their annual travel graphs outlining the best and worst times to cross Snoqualmie Pass, Stevens Pass, the Canadian border, and I-5 just outside of JBLM. We've linked those graphs at MyNorthwest.com. Now, DOT is asking drivers to plan for some extra time for travel. Call 511 for updated road conditions and stay alert for the new lane shifts and work zone staging areas. Now, coming up tomorrow, we will outline the best times to hit I-90, Stevens Pass, and of course, the drive on southbound I-5 down around JBLM.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. We'll get back to dissecting this North Korea development, but just indulge in 60 seconds of kindness. An Arizona family thought their beloved dog was gone forever. He'd been missing for almost a year, but then got an unexpected call that Jake, the dog, had been found 800 miles away in Pennsylvania. The person who found him got his microchip scanned, but that's not where his story ends. The family couldn't go pick him up, couldn't afford to. The rescuer then went a step further, organized a group of 20 volunteers to get Jake home to Arizona. Each volunteer driving Jake as far as they could, and then the handoff.
I drove Jake 120 miles.
I picked up Jake in Conway, Arkansas, and I drove him to Van Buren, Arkansas.
We are about to cross into Maryland.
He made it home to his humans, though the mystery remains of how he ended up so far away.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here's Danny O'Neill. Let's talk about kneeling, Danny, because the NFL owners have finally handed down their judgment on players who kneel during the anthem. We talked about this yesterday when it was still just theoretical. And here's what you had to say at the time. Roll it.
That is maybe the stupidest idea that I've heard come out of the NFL, which is a pretty high bar given all of the different mistakes that they've made.
Now, that was when we were talking in terms of a 15-yard penalty. The actual rule now involves a fine against the team. So how do you feel about that?
I think that this is an end run by the owners around the collective bargaining agreement. And to understand the NFL today, you have to understand that they are all about limiting any liability. It's true with concussion lawsuits. It's true with player safety. All of these things are about them getting out of the way so nobody can be mad at them. And that's essentially what this rule does. It curbs the player's ability to express themselves, which, look, that's not guaranteed in the Constitution. It's a collective bargaining issue. There's a union, and they have a working agreement, and the working agreement does not prohibit players from demonstrating during the national anthem. So what the NFL has done is come up with a different rule, which says any team personnel on the field at the time of the anthem have to show the proper respect for the flag and the anthem. Anybody who does not wish to be on the field is more than welcome to stay in the locker room. And I believe that the attempt, I think that their rationale is that they are going to try to shield themselves from any criticism, that this is about the players' behavior. They've tried to stop it. That's what I think is going on. If people who are concerned about workers' rights, and if it's looking, I've taken enough labor studies classes to know this is about controlling your workforce. That's what the NFL is doing, and they're not doing it by how you would typically do it, which is open up the collective bargaining agreement and negotiate a new behavior code regarding the anthem. They're doing it by some sort of contrived, they're not going to find the player, they're going to find the team, they'll leave it up to the teams. It does, in my mind, it doesn't solve any of the problems, but it does move the NFL out of the line of fire if a politician would happen to, I don't know, it during a rally, single out the NFL and ask why the owners aren't making the players stand.
I know we heard from a couple of Seahawks yesterday about this, or maybe just one, I can't remember, but have the Seahawks as an organization issued a statement on this policy?
No, they haven't. The two teams that we've heard from is first the 49ers, Jed York, abstained from the vote. He also said that the team will stop concession sales during the anthem, that if the anthem has become such a focal point that he doesn't feel right about profiting it or, yeah. From it at the time when you're monitoring players' behavior. And then the New York Jets, whose owner Woody Johnson at one time was going to be an ambassador for Donald Trump, I believe, was going to be appointed an ambassador. Their president has said that the Jets do not plan to monitor or punish, that they'll cover any fines for any of their players' behavior, that they're not going to be in the business of trying to regulate that.
Yeah, how do the players avoid being looked at as unpatriotic if they don't show up on the field for, you know, whatever reason? Maybe they're not quite ready yet. Maybe they have a shoelace untied or something.
It's not about patriotism, though. We have to remember that they're kneeling because of police brutality and
that's
racial
what they
injustice.
Said, but I think it's fair to say the fan perception was that it was anti-patriotic. I mean, the players, yeah, they've argued this all along, but apparently it didn't work because ratings dropped, and hasn't it been, it has been tied to this, right?
Well, I have not seen a definitive analysis that has proven that the NFL ratings drop, and how significant that is, it remains a matter of debate, can be tied to this. People say it is, but we know people say things all the time that don't correlate with the behavior. Here's the thing, Dave, it doesn't shield any of the players at all. It doesn't take anything out. If the NFL forbid all players and said, hey, we're just not going to be on the field for the anthem.
Yeah.
That would be shielding players from the scrutiny over whether or not they were being patriotic. They didn't do that because they know that that would leave them vulnerable, as the owners would say, a politician would say, look, they couldn't even make their own workforce stand during the
anthem. The Players Association can make that the policy, right? Nobody out on the field?
The Players Association can't make a policy across the league. They can ask their membership to do that, and it's certainly within their rights, and we might see that. We might see more whole teams not being out there. That's going to, and this is where I think that there's, what I think the NFL is doing is actually singling out its employees for more scrutiny. If they do that, they're going to face the animosity of the fans, and the NFL teams and owners will be, look, we tried. We tried, and you just can't tell these players what to do.
Yeah. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
The summit is off. The president has canceled it. Let's go to CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy in Washington, D.C. Stephen, one of the questions, well, you asked the question, Colleen, about the reporters who are there.
Yeah, there's journalists in North Korea right now, including your own Ben Tracy over there. Do we know if they're okay?
We've heard from Ben Tracy this morning. He has been on CBS this morning as it's aired in the West. And we are hoping for the best. I have no further information.
Oh, wow.
What we are seeing are reports that the North Korean minders who are with the team of journalists who were there in North Korea to witness the dismantlement, the destruction of a nuclear test site, the minders apparently were unaware of the fact that the summit was being canceled, and they scrambled and left the room and started making telephone calls. The reporters began calling their bureaus in New York and Washington. And what's also apparent is that in Seoul, there's a great deal of activity where it's just after midnight there tomorrow. And the president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, who was just here at the White House the other day, has summoned his national security advisors. What's not clear at the moment is whether word reached Seoul before this letter was released. And that will be an interesting point we'll pursue here at the White House today. But you're right, Colleen. There are American journalists right now in North Korea who were brought there by the North Koreans to witness the destruction of this nuclear site.
I would be shocked if the president released that letter before they were safely out of the country. I mean, that seems to me to be taking a terrible risk, and also a risk to his own calculations, because at this point he can justifiably claim that they got three hostages released, didn't have to give anything in return. But how many journalists are there in all? I mean, there's quite a few.
I don't know how many in total. I know that we have a crew of at least three. That's a correspondent, a producer, and a cameraman. I don't know how many other outlets are represented. I think CNN is also there. But just to be clear, our men are still there in North Korea right now.
Wow. All right. So what's the talk in Washington about what was the last straw for the president on this?
Well, the talk here in Washington is that the last straw, which we haven't fully nailed down, but there's one report that the last straw was a statement that was issued by the North Korean Central News Agency last night, in which they pointed to what Vice President Pence told Fox News earlier this week, basically the standard rhetoric about maximum pressure and this being a bold move of the president to get Kim Jong-un to the table, and how the North Koreans will be expected to denuclearize. There was discussion in that interview about the Libyan model, which is the phrase that John Bolton started using late last month. Obviously, North Korea didn't like that, and we knew that they didn't like that, but the discussion in the interview mentioned the Libya model. And in their statement last night, the North Koreans called Pence a political dummy. They warned of, an appalling tragedy that could befall the United States, one that the U.S. couldn't imagine. And so that's that kind of fiery rhetoric that the president is pointing to in his letter, the tremendous anger and open hostility that he says has rendered a meeting inappropriate. Now, the letter does give Kim Jong-un the opportunity to change his mind about things and come around to a new way of thinking. What's really remarkable, guys, even though there has been, over the last 8 or 9 days, kind of sort of a wariness here in Washington and in other capitals all over the world about this meeting, but what's really striking is the swiftness, how President Trump seems to have turned on a dime, because it was just yesterday that he was saying he was still expressing hope that this meeting would happen, maybe if not on June 12th, that maybe sometime later. But now, this morning, the official position of the president is no, the meeting's off. We know that President Trump is someone who has advocated in the art of the deal that you have to be ready to walk away.
Yes.
But we don't know what the next step is of this president. What's the objective? How are we going to not go back to the fire and fury rhetoric that we had last fall, where folks were really worried that we were inching closer to war with North Korea?
Yeah. Well, I was assuming that the reason for the sudden shift was that he was waiting for the demolition of the nuclear facility, whatever that was, and also giving the reporters some time to get out. Now, you're telling me they're not out yet. So, well, I guess we'll see how that plays out, but that would be pretty irresponsible if that's what happened. I mean, you could wait at least a few hours longer until they got across the border. But so it sounds like everybody's pretty much up in the air. And I was watching the testimony, Secretary Pompeo's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It's clear the committee members were caught up short, too, because their questioning was premised on the idea the talks were going forward. And they really didn't know what to ask at this point. But Pompeo was saying, hey, we're ready to go. So it's not, we didn't cancel it because of we weren't prepared or anything like that. We were ready to go. And I guess it sounds like the president just pulled the plug at the last minute, as you said.
As late as yesterday morning at this time, we had gotten word from the White House that the senior officials from the State Department and the White House were on their way to Singapore this weekend to continue those logistical plans. And yeah. Secretary Pompeo said in his testimony yesterday morning at this time that the summit was still scheduled. Apparently, the last straw was this overnight statement. And a White House official is telling us that the North Koreans literally threatened nuclear war in the statement released last night, that no summit could be successful under those circumstances, the North literally threatening the American people. The White House's position is it was wise of the president to walk away for the time being. And they advise that the U.S. conceded nothing to the North Koreans. We walk away having given up zero. So the position of the White House under President Trump is to take a proud stance that the U.S. has risked nothing, and walking away from this, the loser here, I guess, would be Kim Jong-un. The president, in his letter, calls this a sad moment in history, and he also says that the cancellation of the summit is to the detriment of the world. Where we are right now is just about 2 weeks from the G7 summit. The president is going to Quebec, where the leaders of the industrialized world will be meeting, including the leader of Japan. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will have another opportunity to talk to President Trump about all this. And we'll be at that summit in Quebec. We were expecting to leave directly from that to go to Singapore. At the moment, the Singapore summit is canceled, and that, of course, is the headline of the morning.
Yep. Stephen Portnoy, CBS correspondent, Washington, D.C. Stephen, thank you.
You bet.
With us in the studio, a voice many of you will recognize, CBS News tech analyst Larry Magid. And I guess the biggest news in the tech world, Larry, are the changes in Facebook. I just logged on to my account, and it seems to be normal, but they are now asking you to make privacy selections up front.
That's right, and that's actually in response to a European law, which goes into effect tomorrow. It's called the General Data Privacy Protection, General Data Protection Act. I always get these acronyms wrong, but regulation, GDPR. I'll get it right someday. And basically what it does is it puts a lot of privacy controls in the hands of the user. Companies are very restricted in Europe in terms of what they can do with your information without your permission. So Facebook, for the European audience, had to go back and offer these controls and remind them of what information it has, say that you have the right to limit facial recognition, limit advertising, and they decided to roll out similar controls globally. So we're seeing them here now, but the reason we are is because of this European law.
Oh, good. So we're getting the European regulations without having to pass our own, huh?
Exactly. And the Europeans have always been a lot tougher on privacy than the U.S. legislatures.
So what does that mean then in terms of – because we're all told that the Russians are going to try to interfere in the midterms and try and – does this mean that's going to be more difficult then?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think this really deals with that issue of the Russians interfering. I mean, they are doing other things to make that harder, they say, and one hopes that they are going to follow through on that. But this is really about personal data, personal information. It also affects kids, not in the U.S. directly, but in Europe. In many countries, children under 16 have to have parental permission before they can give out personal information, which means for all practical purposes, they won't be able to use Facebook and other social media unless they have permission.
Facebook's minimum age is 13, right?
In the U.S., it's 13, and that's because of a U.S. law called the COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, that went into effect in 1998.
So that will stay despite the European...
Yeah, that'll stay. It'll be 13 in the U.S., but in some European countries, it'll be 16. But the big issue for the U.S. is that the European privacy protections are coming to us, as you say, without us having to do anything legally.
It came out this week that Donald Trump, who made a huge issue about Hillary Clinton's server, is mm-hmm. himself using a series of unsecured iPhones. Is that, I know it's a big deal on MSNBC, but is it a big deal?
I think it's a big deal. It probably isn't a big deal on other media companies like Fox, but I think it's a big deal because the president should be using a secure device. Now, if he's only using it to tweet, tweets are public anyway, then that's not an issue. But is that device tracking him? Could its microphone be turned on remotely?
Yeah.
iPhones are relatively secure, but they're not bulletproof. Obama had a much more limited bulletproof anemic phone, but that was basically how he was protected.
Surely the iPhones, though, at least go through some kind of security check before they give them to the president, right? I mean, you could unsolder the microphone or something.
Well, I don't know if they've done that. They have turned off GPS, although we always know where he is anyway, but that's been turned off. But the Twitter thing is still working as far as I know.
The FBI a while ago said that there was the big problem they had with this whole smartphone technology is it was too difficult to break into.
Right.
And that they were... I wrote it down here. There were something like 7,800 devices they actively needed to break into to run investigations. It turns out that figure was wildly inflated.
Well, that's interesting. That's not surprising. But the encryption issue still continues. And by the way, there isn't a lot of difference between the Obama position on the encryption and the Trump position on encryption. Both administrations wanted a backdoor of sorts to be able to get into these phones. So that's been an issue for quite a while.
Yeah. So the president also lost a court case on Twitter. Apparently, he cannot block anybody now.
Right, because the real question, if the real Donald Trump is at a public account or a private account, he argues that it's his personal account, but he's proclaiming national policy via that account. And it's not just communication between the public and Donald Trump. It's also conversations among the public. So Donald Trump could tweet something. You could go on there and respond to it. I could then respond to your response. There is a conversation, and I think that the judge is arguing and the plaintiff's attorney, they're arguing that Donald Trump should not have the right to keep you and me from having a conversation around Donald Trump's public proclamations.
So I have a First Amendment right to follow the president.
Right.
You're in town for a special reason. Tell us.
Yeah, I help run an organization called ConnectSafely.org, and we are the official U.S. host of Safer Internet Day, and you are the first to hear that it's going to be in Seattle February 5th. At the Google Complex in the Fremont section, we're going to have hundreds of school kids from throughout the Seattle area coming to learn about Internet safety. And I'm here to scout things out, and I'll be back.
February 5th?
February 5th. Put it on your calendar.
That gives me ample notice.
Ample notice.
To make my reservations.
And I hope I can come back and talk about it later on.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Larry.
My pleasure.
Good to meet you. We haven't met. We've been listening to each other for years.
I started listening to him in 1983 when he did Chip Talk. Does the audience know that? Did I just out you?
They do now.
They do now.
Do now.
Thanks,
Larry.
Thank you.